So, do you ever wonder what happens when we let robots simply play the game of life? That's one of the questions in John Long's book, Darwin's Devices. And he's next with an incredible story on Coast to Coast AM. Well, we've got a fascinating show for you in store. John Long, professor of biology and cognitive science at Vassar College in New York. He serves as the director of Vassar's Interdisciplinary Robotics Research Lab, which he co-founded, and the chair of the Department of Biology as well. Interesting mix here. John and his robots, called Madeline and Tedros, have garnered a number of widespread press coverage in the New York Times, Washington Post, among other publications. We've got a little picture of Madeline, the robot. Looks a little like a turtle. And he and his robots have taught evolution on the Discovery Channel, the History Channel, and he lives in New York. Here he is, John Long, on Coast to Coast, his work, Darwin's Devices. Hey, John, how are you?
Great, George. Thanks very much for having me on the show.
God, I'm looking forward to this. And I was. We'll get into more about Madeline, but how long did it take to develop that thing? and am I okay calling it a thing?
Yeah, absolutely. No, Madeline is a really cool robot because she was a partnership between us at Vassar and a company down in North Carolina called Necton Research. And so Necton had done a lot of work initially on aquatic robots, and then we came along with some biological problems that we wanted to solve with a robot, and we worked together over the course of about 2 years to develop her.
Let's talk, if we can, just about on the theme of robots in general. I keep thinking back to one of Ray Bradbury's great scripts for The Twilight Zone, John. I Sing the Body Electric. And it was about a robot. A family's mother died, and there were a couple little kids. And the father went to the robot store and bought a nanny. And it was a robot. And, you know, the nanny stayed with the family, raised the kids. The kids grew up. The nanny was left and went to another little family that started all over again. Will we ever get to the time when robots will be that sophisticated where they can do almost human-like things like that?
Well, I think that a lot of those capabilities are already there in our robots. I mean, we have, I know it doesn't look like a humanoid nanny, but we've got cleaning robots already with the Roomba. So I think what's going to happen is rather than it being in a single robot, what we'll see is the tasks kind of divvied up amongst little robots. And the Japanese in particular are doing a lot of work on the human-like robots because they're facing the prospect of having a lot of old people and a not very young culture. So they're really worried about exactly the situation you're explaining of who's going to look after folks as they age.
How quickly is the robotic industry moving ahead?
Well, if you look at just the money that's being put in by different governments around the world, there's a lot of initiatives. For example, President Obama last year talked about $70 million for the robotics initiative here in the United States, which is really meant to be a kick in the arm for manufacturing industry. But the yearly sales on global robotics is already on the order of about $20 billion. So
wow.
The money's there, the interest is there commercially, and I think we're well into this kind of fourth industrial revolution.
John, what's making robots so lifelike? Is it the computer? Is it the kind of circuitry, or is it the physical mechanism of, you know, the arm movements and the leg movements? What's happening to it?
Yeah, well, I'm totally biased here because I'm a biologist, and what I see happening with robots is they're becoming more biological, even our commercial ones, in a couple of ways. First of all, we're going beyond the artificial intelligence that you might have seen in the movie 2001, where HAL is a computer. These computers, which are in all these robots, now have a body. And those bodies help define the job and the kind of intelligence the robot has. So having a body is very biological. And also, what we mean by intelligence is really important here, too. The robots that are being built now behave like animals behave. And what I mean by that is they're autonomous. There's no human that's in the control loop, sort of remote controlling them. These robots are making decisions on their own. And so I think it's really biology that has been brought into engineering and cognitive science that's making our robots much more capable.
And what got a biologist interested in robots?
Yeah. Well, you know, I've always been interested in, you know, sort of tinker toys and things like that
sure.
coming up and building motors and stuff. But then I got interested in biology just because there's so much out there that we don't know. So many non-human entities in our own world. It's kind of like being on a different planet if you look at it that way. So, but as a biologist, I got into a situation where I didn't have any more ways to study animals. And so it turns out that by trying to build animal-like machines, that's one way to try to test our ideas about organisms. And so really, I'm a biologist who came to robots in order to understand biology.
And does it give you a pretty clear picture of what biologically these animals are doing in the you know biological life when you look at the robots?
Well, yeah, and one of the things that I talk about in the book, Darwin's Devices, is what engineers have taught me, which is they have what I call a secret code. You know, I don't think an engineer has ever told this to me, but they work by the following principle, which is if you can build it, you can understand it. And so this is what in the world of science we call the synthetic approach. You know, if you can put it together and it operates how you think it should, then you've got a pretty good understanding of the system itself. So that's a very general statement. On specific levels, what we're finding is that if you build good models of animals and they work, we often learn new things about how the animals operate. So there's this wonderful feedback between the biologists and the engineers all the time in terms of we come up with new kinds of things for engineers to do. The engineers in helping us build the robots tell us new things about the animals. We go back and look at the animals and learn new things.
Now, you seem to have concentrated a lot on aquatic-looking robots that function in the water, like Madeline, which I call a turtle. Is that pretty accurate?
That's one way to think of her, yep.
Okay. And then you've also, what, focused on fish? So why the aquatic end?
Well, one of the things that robots offer to a biologist like me is a new way to look at old problems. And old problems, I mean literally, what happened 500 million years ago on this planet in terms of evolution? And, you know, this is the kind of thing that makes me sleepless at night and wants to be on radio programs with you.
That's right.
You know,
you'll be up all night on this one, John.
Exactly. You know, why did the first vertebrates evolve? So what are vertebrates? They're the group of animals to which we belong that have backbones.
That's right.
And the backbones are the vertebral column with our intervertebral discs that drive us crazy as we age because they degenerate and so forth. And so our whole group of animals really depends on evolving this primary skeleton that's inside our body. And so I'm driven mad by that question of why did that happen evolutionarily? Well, 500 years ago, fossils tell no tales. There's no behavior that we can unearth, just bones that we can look at. And so how do we sort of reenact the evolutionary processes that might have driven the evolution? And we do that using the robots. And all these robots are built like fish because those first vertebrates were fish.
Are you learning from these robots at this point?
Absolutely. We're able to test our ideas about what are the evolutionary pressures that may have caused vertebrae to evolve. And one of the things we've learned that's really interesting is you can talk about kind of basic survival stuff, feeding and getting away from predators, so eating and not being eaten. Those kind of conditions are sufficient to allow these fish-like robots to evolve more bones in their back.
Interesting. I mean, do they actually react, the robots? Do they react to possibly being attacked or something?
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the things that is very realistic about these special kinds of robots that we build that are called biorobots. They have, first of all, they're physically embodied. This is not on a computer. This is in the world. And so they have sensors that allow them to have the equivalent of eyes and the equivalent of this special organ that fish have called a lateral line, which is like an inside-out ear that allows it sits along the body of the fish and allows it to sense pressure waves in the water. And so it can take in sensory input, make decisions on its own, it's autonomous that way, and then it can create movement based on that information. And there's a feedback. It moves, it changes the information it gets, and that system continues. So when we actually put these robots together in a big 10-foot-wide pool in our laboratory, we turn them all on, and we stand back and we watch them. They're not remote controlled. They're acting on their own. We don't know how the experiments are going to turn out until we run them.
What are some of the strangest things that have happened, John, in these experiments? I mean, that just baffled you. Anything?
Well, yeah, here's the strangest thing. I mean, we are interested in the vertebral column. So we allow that structure to vary, and we have an artificial genetics system, which is just a fancy way of talking about ways to code for and pass along to the next generation what's happening in terms of building the number of these vertebrae. And so we'll have a population of robots. We start out with six of them that are all slightly variable in terms of their vertebral column, their backbone. And they all, because of that, behave slightly differently. And what happens that's a surprise to us is, even though we're not allowing the brain to evolve, these fish-like robots, the Tadros that you mentioned, actually get more intelligent over generational time, even though the brain isn't changing. So this was a real surprise to us, because you don't need to change the brain in order to get smarter.
That's interesting. And how long does it take to make one of these, like a fish?
Yeah, so once we have the basic robotic platform in hand and build a bunch of these, which can take, depending on what you're designing, you know, 6 months to a year, doing the experiments can take a whole generation. You can do in about a week. And we use a special kind of engineering to make the parts we're trying to evolve, these backbones, called biomimetics. And biomimetics is, mimesis is from the word mimic. So it's where we actually go in and try to build wet and floppy materials, just like animals are wet and floppy. And we make these artificial vertebral columns that we actually have to keep wet, because they're made of collagen. And collagen is the main protein that's in our skin.
Yeah, that is amazing. Tissues. Not that you would, but could you make a piranha-looking robot with teeth and have it attack people?
Oh, you know, sure, if you wanted to be crazy, you could. And to do something like that. We actually put a predator in with our Tadros. It doesn't have teeth, but is very single-minded like a predator is, and its job is to go after the Tadros.
And it chases and them?
It does, yeah. And it's, again, it's making its own decisions in the laboratory, and it's of no danger to us as humans. But its job is to hunt down those Tadros while they're trying to feed. And the Tadros are built to be sensitive to this predator and to detect when it's around and try to escape. So that's the game of life in our laboratory.
That is amazing. And do they escape? What, I mean, what happens? Does this thing ever catch one of the others?
Absolutely. You know, it's a very tight race that's happening in every generation. And that's really what makes, we actually have to design the robots so that the predator isn't too good. Because if the predator is too good, the game of life is over in one generation and nothing happens.
You know, I can see one day, this is bizarre, John, but instead of having, you know, two guys duking it out in the middle of a ring in a boxing match, you have a couple robots do it. And they just...
movies like that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that technology's going to be there, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, it's always hard to know how many years you are away from something. But we certainly have the basic technological understanding, George, to do just as you're saying, which is to build humanoid robots that do that kind of boxing, or we could build your piranhas, right, and have our fish and fight.
It tells you where my mind is headed these days, huh?
That's right.
Well, I mean, robots have always fascinated me since I was a kid. And, you know, I used to watch the Jetsons on television, and they had that maid doing what she did. And, I mean, I've just watched this evolution. You know, in Japan, they've got... what's his name? Osimo? Is that the name of that one?
Exactly right. And that's named after Asimov, the great writer.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, and Osimo, you know, the Japanese, again, they've put a lot of time and money into these humanoid robots. And so, yeah, they're the closest ones to having the Jetson-like robotic maids. And what's interesting is, so Mitsubishi has put money into it. Honda has put money into these robots. And I think they've done it incorrectly, actually. All their efforts have been put into how the robots move, and they haven't really dealt with the autonomy yet. And the autonomy is acting on your own.
Which is what you're working on.
That's right. And, you know, and I'm not the only one working on autonomy. Within the world of robotics, autonomy is a very important part of the robots that people build. I mean, the Roomba that you can buy from iRobot that will clean your floors is an autonomous robot. And we take it for granted because, you know, it's just moving around and, you know, scooping up dirt on the floor. But it's making decisions on its own.
Well, you know, I've seen these, you know, and I've seen clips of, like, the Roomba. And you look at that and you go, first of all, to try to clean under your bed is almost impossible. First of all, most vacuums won't fit under there, and you can't reach under there. It's unbelievable. So you sit back and you go, you know, theoretically, if you don't move your bed for 7 years, you could have a cake full of dust under there. This little robot that you just mentioned would take care of that problem, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. And that's exactly the way that the folks at iRobot think about the next market for robots is, what is the tedious, the dull, the dangerous, the dirty thing that humans don't really want to do, and can we make a robot that does that specific task? So, for example, there are now lawn mowing robots, right? Another kind of dull task that not many people I know want to do.
That's right.
For example. And so we pay for other people to do it, or we do it ourselves grudgingly. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the really exciting things about robotics as an industry right now is it's really ripe for entrepreneurs. People like you, George, who have these great ideas about what needs to be done around the house, or mm-hmm. workplace, underwater, in the air, and people have enough kind of knowledge now about programming computers and a lot of this material's available off shelves that they can do things like decide that they're going to go into surveillance and create a robotic airplane that flies above celebrity houses out west in California and takes pictures of celebrity houses.
Amazing.
So aerial paparazzi right now.
Yeah. Where do you see the robotic world in 10 years?
Well, I think in 10 years, the robotic world is going to include the following. We're going to have cars, which we allow to drive themselves with us in them.
Testing them in Vegas now, aren't they?
Exactly right. Yeah. The Google cars, for example. And we're starting to see states pass laws that will allow them to operate on our roads. And what's going to be the biggest resistance is people don't want to let go of the wheel.
That's scary.
Yeah, exactly. But, I'd rather have the car driving itself than, let's say, a drunk guy driving the car.
No question. No question.
You know, these cars can be built to be very, very safe. And right now we're already seeing the kind of incremental, step-by-step changes that allow us as humans to slowly get used to these ideas. So this is getting to your 10-year question. So we start to see things like Roomba, which are simple sorts of robots. We start to see more sophisticated toys. Toys are one way to get robots into our heads, into our psyche. And if you can afford certain kinds of cars, like a Lexus, you can already see robotic capabilities in your Lexus. Actually, if you can afford a Ford Focus, the Ford Focus will now do the horrible job that we don't like to do called parallel parking.
Right? And pretty darn well, too.
Exactly. So, what we're going to see over these next 2 years is more and more of these tasks are going to creep into our existing machinery, and then in 10 years, we'll be able to say to the car, okay, I want you to be fully autonomous now. I'm going to text.
Right? Yeah, exactly. And you can get away with it then.
Exactly
they're
right.
They're going to have to change the rules a little bit. You know, I'm a horrible backseat driver. You know, look out, turn right, you know, do this. I can just imagine me with a robot driving the car, you know.
Well, I think it'll be under voice command, right? And if it's not driving the way you like, you can tell it, look, Rosie, slow down, will you? Or you're tailgating too much. And what's going to happen, and this is where some of the work we do comes into play, is we already have the ability to program machines to learn. And so machines will be, part of what we'll see happening is we'll actually bring these robots into our lives. They won't be scary humanoid robots. They'll have other shapes and colors and things like that. And then we'll go through a period of training with them where we actually teach them how we want them to behave in our lives.
Just amazing. Would you even need a driver's license by that time?
Oh, boy, that's a great point. And wouldn't it be nice? I mean, we're all getting older, right? And we worry about our independence as we age. And I know that For many of us who live in more rural areas, our car is really the thing that we depend on.
It's the lifeblood. Yeah.
Exactly. And imagine that when we would have to maybe move into an assisted living facility, instead all we need is a robotic car that can take us around for groceries.
Let's talk more about this, John. Dr. John Long with us. We're talking about his work with evolving robots. Fascinating. Much more to talk about. We're going to get into some controversies later about evolution as well. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with John Long tonight. His book, Darwin's Devices. That's right. It's all about robots. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back with John Long. You know, John, my dad died a few months ago, 88 years old. But several years ago, we had to take his car keys away from him. I mean, he was at a point where he didn't know where he was going, didn't know how to get back. And, you know, he would have been dangerous to himself and others. But it was at that point, I really believed that, you know, he started going downhill. At that point, when you have to take away the, you know, the car from someone, and that's his way of getting around and going out and doing what he did, it's the beginning of the end. So, I would guess robotic cars would help a lot of people, wouldn't it?
Oh, well, absolutely. And George, I'm sorry to hear about your dad.
Thank you.
But, yeah, to your point, I think mobility is something that we really underappreciate as humans. We're so focused on our brains and the size of our heads being the seat of our intelligence that we forget that we're actually really mobile creatures. We're mobile in terms of how we walk around and what we can do, running, all those various ways that we move in our world to learn about our world. And cars are a piece of technology that's extended our ability to move around, to support ourselves. And now robots and robotic cars are going to be another way that we can really extend and maintain our movement that's really essential to the way that we live as animals in this world of technology.
In a crude way, you know, manufacturing plants have had robots in there for years. I mean, you know, machines that stamp out, the capsule of a pill, or, you know, the automobile industry had robots a long time ago. They didn't look like people, but they were robots, weren't they?
Well, they were in a very limited sense, which is what I think you're getting at. You know, they didn't have to be mobile in the way we're talking about it. They just stood in place, usually their arms, right, that just go out there and put in a rivet or something.
And they didn't think, they were just there.
That's right, and you just put your finger on something really important. You know, what is thinking here that we're talking about? They can be programmed in a very simple way to, okay, every 10 seconds I'm going to reach out and grab a bolt and screw on that bolt. That's very different than even what a room cleaning vacuum cleaner does, which is to say, okay, I'm going to move in a semi-random pattern around here, and when my battery's drained down, I'm going to go back to my charger and charge up, and then I'm going to come out again, right? Those are very different kinds of tasks.
Mm-hmm.
First one, the industrial robots, are the dull stuff. I just have to do the same thing, boom, 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 every moment. There's no change in that, and that's a very structured world that's actually quite easy to program a machine to do.
It's amazing. Amazing technology. I want to get into evolution and some controversies behind robots as well. We'll do that next hour. So, John, how did you get involved with this? I mean, you were a biologist first, I assume?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm really interested in how animals work. And so there's a part of me that thinks like an engineer, and there's part of me that just loves learning about different kinds of creatures. And, you know, I fell in love with fish and dolphins and whales, watching an old program called Jacques Cousteau.
Ah, yes.
And so I was a kid watching Jacques Cousteau and saying, oh my gosh, you know, we don't know anything about what life underwater is like. And in fact, we still don't, right? We know more about the surface of the moon than we do about the bottom of the ocean. And so I really wanted to explore those kind of life forms, and I got really fascinated with the different way that animals move. And so I've taken a path through biology that's called biomechanics, which is where you learn engineering principles. So principles, mathematical principles that humans use to make stuff that works, and you apply it in a reverse engineering way to understanding how animals work. So I'm really interested in trying to figure out how, say, marlin can do this amazing stuff of jumping out of the water and, 5 feet into the air, which is this explosive kind of event. Or a spinner dolphin can do the same thing, but go up to 20 feet. You know, things like that just fascinate me. So that's how I got started in the biology and that broad piece of engineering with it. And then there was a point where I just wanted to say, okay, if we actually know how we think these animals are operating as athletes, then we ought to be able to build simplified versions of them that use those principles that we think are operating and build these spectacular robots.
As a biologist, strange question here, but Why are there so many different species of animals on this planet? I mean, it's unbelievable.
I don't think that's a strange question at all. I think that's a wonderful question. And, you know, I'm just going to go back a little bit to all of our childhoods here. You know, we all kind of grow up all the time saying, gee whiz, you know, look at that. I can't know what all the plants are that are out in the garden here, or look at the many species of birds that are out there. You know, and there's this wonderful thing I get to do as a scientist, which is to continually ask and try to answer those sort of gee whiz questions. So it's very much like, as I tell my students sometimes, you know, you're never too old to be immature. And what I mean about that is to have the innocence to ask those gee whiz questions. And so your gee whiz question about why are there so many life forms is a one that just drives biologists crazy. And this is where studies about evolution come into play. And what we think has happened over the 1 to 1.5 billion years that life has been on this planet is that there has been changes in the environment over time that have changed the conditions for life, and life responds differently to those different conditions and brings with it its own history. And at any moment in time of life on this planet, the life forms that are around to evolve are quite different. So part of what we see over time is an expansion of the different kinds of life forms. And so what we also don't see, though, which is really interesting, is that some kinds of life forms have never evolved. We can imagine them, but evolution hasn't taken us there. And my favorite, I have a couple of daughters, and they've always been interested in Pegasus, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why don't we have flying horses, Dad? Well, I don't really know. But what we do know is we've never had vertebrates, this group to which horses belong, animals with backbones, that have six different pairs of arms and legs.
That's right.
So that would be a condition that you'd need to have in order for a Pegasus-like creature to form. And so some of those answers to why things haven't occurred are as interesting as the answers to why have they occurred.
I really want to find a unicorn. I want to find a unicorn.
Well, you know, there's a really strange critter, speaking about, back to your point about why all these life forms, called a narwhal, which is a Arctic, it's kind of a cross between if you know what a beluga whale looks like, which is a white whale.
Yeah.
A narwhal is kind of a brown whale, about the same size as a beluga, and it's got an incisor, one of its front teeth, that has exploded out of the front of its head and formed this giant 6-foot-long tusk. And the thought is that when explorers from the north came back bringing a narwhal tusk, it looks just like what we represent in mythology as the unicorn's horn. So, in fact, a narwhal in some ways is as crazy as a unicorn. An animal with one front tooth that's jammed out of its head and making this big tusk.
See, I come from the old school, John, where everything has a purpose, whatever it might be. And, you know, so when you look at tusks on an elephant or the horn on a rhino or just about anything on this planet, I mean, it's strange how nature has given all these creatures these different things for their own other purpose.
Well, I think that's one of the fascinating things about all the diversity you're talking about here, which these items, these creatures, have come about because of this process of evolution, which is pretty straightforward to understand. And yet, what we don't fully understand is in each case, how did that come to be? And part of that mystery there is it takes millions of years and tiny little changes that have to accumulate from generation to generation for some of these changes to take place. And so now I'm going to put my hat on as a cognitive scientist.
Okay.
And tell you about something that's called change blindness. And we are change blind to slowly moving changes in our world. And, for example, if you were to Google change blindness, you could find some really interesting videos of say just looking at a cafe, and they say, okay, over 3 minutes just watch this video, and you watch the video, and then they ask you, okay, what changed? And you say, well, nothing changed. And then you go back and you find out that they've recolored over that 3 minutes the cafe from being yellow to green,
or they took a stool out or something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so there's some fascinating examples. Depending on how slowly something works or what else we're attending to, we can be totally blind, inattentive to the other stuff that's happening. And that's why it's so hard for humans to really feel like we're experiencing evolution is because it happens so slowly, we don't see it in front of us.
That's true. Yet some people would be quicker at picking up change than others.
Absolutely. And it depends on, a lot of it is, you know, what you're brought up as a child or as a professional adult to pay attention to. I mean, as someone who has studied animal evolution and animal locomotion, how animals move, I can't help, this drives my friends crazy, I can't help but notice the way they walk. And so if somebody has, you know, just spent a weekend being a weekend warrior, and they come into work and they're just hobbling a little bit, I say, you know, what did you do to your right ankle? And they're like, what do you mean? Were you watching me this weekend? I said, no. I can just tell you're moving completely differently because you're not putting as much weight for as much time on that right foot. And so, I mean, we all bring a different kind of attention to the world based on what we're used to looking at.
Well, and I'll tell you another thing that fascinates me about creatures on this planet, humans and animals and insects. It's the similarity of all of them. I mean, from eyes, nose, mouth, ears. I mean, they've all got them.
Well, and it gets to a really important point, George, and that is, this is one of the reasons that pieces of evidence that we have that life evolved from a single life form, that there's been this tree of evolutionary change over millions of years. And part of the clues that we use to reconstruct that idea are the traits that we all share.
Yeah, we really do. I mean, we could go on, John, for 16 shows just to talk about stuff like this. I mean, for ethnicity, for example, the races. I mean, we have African Americans, we have Asians, we have people who are Caucasians. We're all human beings, but we're all different too. How did that happen?
Well, here's one of the keys to creating diversity. So back to the question you posed at the beginning of this segment, which is how do we get all these different life forms? One of the ways that happens is we isolate small subpopulations, and so that they breed together in limited ways without a lot of immigration into the population.
And is it geographical?
It's a geographical isolation is how we think that we get a lot of diversity. So let me give you an example. The famous case of the Galapagos Islands, which Darwin visited before he had developed the theory of evolution.
Right, right.
And the Galapagos Islands are far enough away from the west coast of South America that you can't swim there if you're an animal, or it's even difficult to fly there. And so Darwin gets there, and there are all these creatures that, to your point, look similar, but they also look different.
Yeah.
Hey, wait a minute, what's going on here? And so it's when you have isolated populations that we tend to see rapid evolutionary change. And so you were talking about humans. So until very recently, humans existed in isolated populations. And so in each different kind of region of the world, because they were alone, in essence, relative to other humans, you would find them evolving and having very different kinds of what we call phenotypes, that is, appearances. So, for example, you mentioned African Americans, and then we've also got the Caucasians and things like that. And in some ways, the differences between those kinds of people are as simple as the pigmentation in your skin.
Sure.
And so back to your point about looking for reasons and purpose for all this, one idea that geneticists have about where white skin came from is that it's an adaptation for being in northern climates, where there's less sunlight, and sunlight is essential for making vitamin D.
Sure.
And so that what happens is that if you're going to survive and be up in the Arctic or up in the temperate regions like this, you need less pigmentation that's actually protective in your skin. So it's one idea is the differences that unfortunately we make so much hay about as humans just have to deal with an adaptation for vitamin D.
If a human being survived and lived for hundreds and hundreds of years, thousands of years, and evolved inside the planet, like in a cave or something, never saw sunlight, basically never saw light, what would they look like? What do you think?
Well, so first of all, yeah, so if there was a group of them, right, one of the things that happens with evolution is that, unfortunately, this is going to be a bummer for you, but as individuals, we don't evolve. Right, we can develop and change developmentally,
okay.
But evolution is really changes that occur from generation to generation. So it's differences between the group of parents and then their offspring.
And then their offspring all the way down.
Exactly. So if you allowed in your thought experiment there for there to be a group of cave-dwelling humans, what we would see is, depending on the challenges in that cave, we might come up with very different kinds of humans after really as little as even 10 generations, there might be important differences. And so without the sunlight, for example, humans that are individuals in that group that could do better without vitamin D, for example, might be able to produce more offspring.
Right.
That's the game of life, making more offspring than somebody else. Or there might be differences in how you can handle what might be very damp conditions. You know, maybe some people are very prone to, forgive me, athlete's foot.
Yeah.
Right? And so if you have a natural kind of ability to fight athlete's foot, maybe you're going to survive better. You know, your skin's not going to peel off and you're not going to get infections. And so one of the things that I can't do for you very well, I mean, we can come up with scenarios, you know, and so maybe you're hairier underground too because you want to be warmer. Who knows?
Or pasty looking with huge eyes. Who knows, you know?
Exactly. But one of the fun things, or fascinating things, really, about evolution is you never know quite where you're going to go. And so evolution is exploration by life of different kinds of life forms. And so when we think about kind of rewinding the tape of evolution and replaying it as another kind of thought experiment, would we be here again? It's almost like the time paradox movies or TV shows. My favorite is, I don't know if you remember The Simpsons, one of the Halloween episodes where Homer has the magic toaster.
Time machine.
And, you know, every time he puts in a piece of toast, he goes back in time. And, you know, one time he hits he's back in the Jurassic, and he stomps on a big bug, right? And he's like, oh, this can't be good. And then he goes back in time, and his family has, you know, snake-like tongues or something like that. You know, so you never know which differences are going to matter as you go forward. And so we could take some general guesses and come up with what's feasible and what's not feasible. And we do the same thing in Darwin's devices, looking back at the past. In essence, we're trying to retro-predict. We're trying to understand what is feasible that might explain what's happened in the past as well. So either looking forward or backward is a very similar process.
I've got to ask you this, too, before we get to the break, John. As a biologist, people are seeing a creature, some call Sasquatch, others call Bigfoot. I don't know what it is, but they're seeing something, obviously. They can't all be making up these stories. As a biologist, I mean, have you ever looked at that and said, what is this? Is it an ape? Is it the missing link? What is it? Do biologists think about stuff like that?
Well, you know, I have to say that it would be so cool if Sasquatch actually existed.
Right.
Because what I've seen from, you know, some of the classic pictures is a very large hominid, a very large ape-like creature. It would clearly be closely related to us. And let me tell you something that has a bit more scientific credibility, but that's quite similar. You may have heard about the so-called hobbits that were found.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And these are very small human-like creatures that went extinct probably about 300 to 700 years ago. So we find their bones in caves. And what's really interesting is the New Guineans have fables about these fairy-like creatures, right? Well, guess what? You find the fossils.
There they are.
Kind of hidden woods. Yep. And so if we could find evidence like that for Bigfoot, Sasquatch, whatever, that would just be really fascinating.
Might the hobbits still be alive out there somewhere?
Well, you know, nobody has seen any evidence that they are out there. And the problem is that the more that we grow in population size as humans and the more that we alter the landscape, the fewer surprises there are.
Well, that's true. John, we're going to take this break. We're going to come back and talk about some of the controversies in evolution. The book, of course, Darwin's Devices, What Evolving Robots Can Teach Us About the History of Life and the Future of Technology. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.